And then about a week before it happens, somebody will call you or send you an email. Hey, you remember you're coming up here to do this thing? Well, Shane had been in constant contact with me and set it up, arranged it, advertised it, and just an exemplary job of putting an event together, especially an event on a Saturday morning. And I appreciate the fact that I was allowed to be included in that. So we spent the day yesterday talking about relationships. And usually when I do a seminar, it's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday sort of thing. And so normally on Sunday mornings, I like to talk kind of in an eclectic way about our relationship with the church. Because I know we've got single folks, we've got married folks, we've got younger folks, we've got older folks. And so rather than do something that is relationship specific to marriages, I thought we'd just talk about our relationship with the church. Because the church is an organism, not an organization. And I'm afraid sometimes we make the mistake of over-organizing the church and not letting it function organically like it was designed to do, because really you get people of different ages and different backgrounds and different experiences together, and that could create some very unique problems. And a perfect case study for this is the city of Corinth. If you turn to 1 Corinthians 12, we'll spend a little time there. The city of Corinth had 250,000 free people. That's just a little bit north of the population of Huntsville, Alabama. You had 250,000 people living on this little isthmus, and it was a center for a trade route. You had 400,000 people in the city of Corinth that were slaves. So you outnumbered the free people almost 2-1, and then the gospel comes to Corinth. And when the gospel comes to Corinth, you have slaves and you have free people who become Christians. And now they're worshiping together. Imagine a Sunday morning service where the owned and the owners are sitting in the same assembly. Now, sometimes in the first century, slavery was simply like a job. And so a slave could be married. A slave could have children. So a slave becomes a Christian. And 10 years later, his wife's a Christian. His children are faithful Christians. You really could have a slave that was qualified to be an elder. You imagine submitting to your slave as an elder? You imagine just the difficulties. And not only did you have slave people and free people worshiping together in the city of Corinth, you had two basic culture differences. You had a group of people that came from the Jewish tradition, from the Jewish background. They were practicing a version of Judaism that was not covenant relationship, and we don't have time to talk about that. They didn't have an Ark of the Covenant. They hadn't had an Ark of the Covenant 600 years. You'll notice in the New Testament, they talk about Passover, Passover, Passover. They never talk about Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. They couldn't do Day of Atonement. They didn't have an Ark. So they kind of put together the best they could do with Judaism. And so they held on to a lot of their symbols. They held on to a lot of their traditions. One of the problems in the New Testament was the Jewish people had taken ceremonial cleanliness and it elevated ceremonial cleanliness to some kind of sign of righteousness. And so there was food that they wouldn't eat. It wasn't that they couldn't eat. God had already wiped that away. But they held on to these Jewish traditions, and they were just food that they were not, in their tradition, considered it still to be unclean. Now, if you read the Levitical food law and you look at what basically the restrictions was, you couldn't eat anything that was a predator. You couldn't eat anything that was a scavenger. And that's it. If it tore another animal's flesh to eat it, you couldn't use it. And if it ate something that had already been killed by some other means, you couldn't do it. So they couldn't eat anything that was a predator or a scavenger. In the water, they could eat anything with scales and fins, which means that there were some predator fish. But you'll notice all your predator fish eat things whole. They don't chew things up like your largemouth bass and your gar and your crappie and that kind of stuff. But they couldn't eat catfish. They couldn't eat shrimp. They couldn't eat lobster. And they had these really, really strong convictions about stuff they couldn't eat. Now, when a Jewish person thought something was unclean, it wasn't just that we wish we could have it and we can't. It was they thought it was nasty. When they saw unclean food, it was like this was roadkill armadillo to them. I mean, it was just unappealing as it could be. I'm on a restricted diet. We don't have time for that story either, but something happened to one of my large intestines and it blew out on me on a hunting trip, and I wore one of those wonderful little bags and took myself to the hospital and all this kind of cool. And there are things the doctor says you should not eat. Well, the things that I'm not supposed to eat, I wished I could eat. I've never met a donut I couldn't be friends with. I'm telling you right now. If I could have a donut right now, I'd take one of those Krispy Kreme donuts. I'd take a little square of butter, put it on it, and melt it in the microwave. I'd take a Wendy's Frosty, put it in the middle. I'd take some honey and drizzle it over the top of it, and I'd eat that with a spoon. I'd have a headache for 7 years, but I'd eat that right now. Right now, I'd do that. So when I see a Krispy Kreme donut, part of my mind says, you're not supposed to have that. And my heart says, man, I wish I could. You know, a Jewish person sees the thing they're not supposed to eat, and they're like, oh, man. Gentiles didn't have any restrictions at all. They literally ate things with blood in them. They ate things that were unclean. They ate things that were despicable. Can you imagine potluck Sunday at Corinth? You got this one table, you got this other table, and this table makes people throw up, and this table doesn't. God told Moses, when you build an altar to me, you do not approach that altar with steps. You approach it with a ramp, lest the nakedness of your priests become uncovered. He's basically wanting them to approach his altar with decorum, and basically God knows people. So if Jerry and I are sitting in a room and Dale's wearing a robe and he starts up the steps and he gives us a little thigh, me and Jerry will crack up. And probably God would burn us to the ground. So God's just protecting us from ourselves. So he says, you don't uncover the nakedness of your priests. They heard that religious restriction for decorum and they went crazy with modesty. The men covered themselves from head to toe. They covered their women from face to feet. You read in the New Testament where a Jewish man runs, that's a really out of behavior for them. Because in order for a Jewish man to run, he's got to pull his robe up and run. A guy runs to meet Jesus, he's breaking social protocol. They picture God as running to meet the Son, because the Jews thought it was very, very inappropriate to uncover the nakedness. And they took that one restriction about worship decorum and they used it as a thing to make modesty this huge, big deal. Gentiles, not so much worried about that. The Isthmian Games that were played, the precursor to the Olympic Games that were played in Corinth, those games were played absolutely in the nude. Or as we say in Alabama, buck naked, all right? If you went to the Isthmian Games and all the games that Paul's referring, the Greek word gymnos means naked. And they would show up for their athletic events and not wearing a stitch. And you think Under Armour makes you uncomfortable? You'd give good money for some Under Armour at one of these games. I'll tell you that right now. Now imagine the guy gets up on making announcements. The youth group is going to play flag football on Saturday. I'm sorry, the Jewish kids won't play on Saturday. The youth group is going to play flag football on Monday. And remember, no shorts. Jewish kids go, Roger that. We'll wear our football robes. Gentile kids, no problem. We weren't wearing shorts anyway. And then you show up for the ball game and it's a mess. And these people are trying to worship together. These people are trying to have church together. These people are trying to take their histories and their expectations and their social status and their cultural differences and come together to make a body. And Paul says, let's talk about that. Now, as Paul begins to talk about it, because they weren't handling their differences with maturity, Paul's going to basically take two tacks. One, he's going to introduce the concept of different but same. And as we read this passage, you'll hear different, same, different, same, different, same, different, same. And then he's going to talk about many but one. And once he does different, same, and many but one, he's then going to basically say, hey, there's three things that really can't happen in a body. There's three ridiculous situations that should never occur in an organism. They can occur in organizations, but you don't want these things to happen in an organism. There's three things that just can't happen in a body. And from those three things, we'll probably have some axioms for how you and I should interact with the body as a body of believers. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 4. There are diversities, fancy word for differences. There are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. So now listen, different, same, different, same. There are differences of ministries, same Lord. there are diversities of activities, but it's the same God who works all in all. Now, the manifestation, the different ways the Spirit can be seen, the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all. Now, he's going to list some differences without saying the word different. For to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit, to another the word of knowledge through the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts of healing by the same Spirit, to another workings of miracles, to another prophecy, to another discerning of spirits, to another different kinds of tongues, to another interpretation of tongues. But one and the same Spirit works in all these things, distributing to each one individually as he wills. Different, same, different, same, different, same, different, same. We got different backgrounds, we got different talents, we got different exposures, but guess what? We're the same people. We're the same body. We're the same organism. And then he's going to switch and start talking about many but one. For as the body is one, but has many members, but all the members of that one body being many are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit, we were all baptized into one body. Now, if the body is the church and the church is the body, the only way you get to be a member of the body is through baptism. And if you talk to anybody who doesn't believe in the essentialness of baptism for salvation, there you have it. You can't be a member of the body without being baptized into it. And if you are not baptized, you're not a member of the body. If you're not a member of the body, you're not a member of the church. It doesn't get much plainer than that. For by one Spirit, we're all baptized into one body, whether, and that's not a word I use in conversation. I just don't typically use the word whether. So in Alabama, we would translate that as it don't matter. So we'll read this in the Alabama translation. For by one Spirit, we're all baptized into one body, and it don't matter if you're a Jew or a Greek, and it don't matter if you're slave or free. Paul has now talked about the four things we talked about in our introduction. He said, look, we're all part of the same body. You got entrance to the body, and it wasn't because you're free. It wasn't because you're a slave. It wasn't because you're a Greek. It wasn't because you're a Jew. You were baptized into the body, and it really doesn't matter what your background is. It doesn't matter what your history is. It doesn't matter what your past is. You're a member of the body because you were baptized into the body, and that changes your dynamic with the people here. And your relationship is not demographic. My actual title at the church that I work with in Huntsville is I'm the intergenerational minister. And that probably actually means I'm too old to work with the kids and too young to work with the senior citizens. It's probably what it actually means. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to take those labels, the youth group, the adult group, the seniors group, the curtain climber group, whatever, and quit worrying about those demographics. I get asked so many times as a counselor to talk about the special needs of certain demographics of the church. The New Testament church didn't worry about demographics. They had one special demographic. They treated widows in a special way. And that was it. Because Paul will say there's neither slave nor free, Jew nor Greek, nor Scythian nor barbarian. You don't ever have a New Testament church, a guy get up and make announcements. Today there'll be a meeting of the Scythian ministry in the fellowship hall. All non-Scythians are welcome to it. He said, it's not what the church does for your age group. It's not what the church does for your demographic. It's not what the church does for the Greeks or the Jews or the slaves or the free. But you've been brought into the church and you have a role in the church. Now fulfill that role and quit worrying about the label you brought with you when you came into the church. Because the body's not just one thing. It's made up of very many members. And those members make up one body. It really doesn't matter what your label is. Jew, Greek, slave, or free. Go back to the text, verse 14. For in fact, the body is not one member, but many. So we have this idea that Paul is going to start talking about a mindset, a cognitive framework that says once you start to view yourself in this way, it will change your functionality. I use the phrase to talk about this, corporate individuality. Now, corporate means a big thing, individual means one thing, and corporate individuality is what Paul's trying to talk about. A mindset that says, I know I'm part of something big, but I got an individual function. Now, corporate individuality is kind of like an oxymoron. It's like jumbo shrimp or Kentucky football. It's things that don't go together. And so when you start thinking about corporate individuality, it's the idea that I've got to change the way I think about this group. It's not just me. It's not just you. But it's us. And so after he talks about many but one and different but same, Now he's going to outline some things that just shouldn't happen in a body, things that don't happen in an organism. Verse 15, if the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? First thing he talks about is you don't have a body part that says, hey, I don't like my job, I quit. If you have a body part that says, I don't like what I'm doing, and it stops working, what happens to you? Have you ever had a body part quit working for you? Well, this means yes. This means no. This means you're not voting, all right? If you wake up and you've been sleeping on your arm and it goes to sleep and you try to answer the iPhone with it, you ever had that experience? You sit with your legs coiled up on the couch and the doorbell rings and you jump up and hit the floor? You ever had something in one of your eyes? You ever had something happen to your inner ear where you didn't have balance? Listen, if you've got a body part that says, today I'm not going to work, it affects the entire balance and the entire functionality of the body. What happens if you decide not to do your job? If you decide not to fulfill your role in this body, then you throw the balance of the body off course. What's the most important part of your car? Now, we can begin to discuss automotive theory. We could begin to discuss differential joints and injector plugs and brake pads and steering columns and all kinds of things. If you start out here on the highway and you get a pop-up thunderstorm and you don't have a $7 piece of rubber that does this, you'll park that car. Because the most important part of your car is the part that you need to be working when it's not working. Your role in this building, your role in this body is you've got something to do, and if you don't do it, it affects the functionality of the whole group. And doing our job gives us value. Now, your specific job doesn't give you a specific value. You have value simply because you have a job, and that's it. I have one daughter. She's grown now, married, got two babies. She played college volleyball. She was a volleyball player as a munchkin and a volleyball player in high school and a volleyball player in college. Doesn't mean anything to you except she's 4'10" and played college volleyball. She's meaner than a one-eyed water moccasin. I mean, she really is a tough kid. And she played a little position called libero, and that's the back row passer who wears a different colored jersey, has unlimited substitution. To our knowledge, she's the smallest person to ever play Division I volleyball. She's a tiny little thing. And one day, with her passion for volleyball, she said, hey, Dad, I want you to make me a T-shirt. And I draw a little bit. She said, I want you to make me a T-shirt, and I want it to have a volleyball on it. And a volleyball is really easy to draw 9 lines. 3 lines this way, 3 lines this way, 3 lines this way. She said, I want it to have a volleyball on it, but the lines of the volleyball, I want them to be in sentences. And I want the top of the shirt to say, there is no I in team, which I get, but there is in unity. There is no I in team, but there is in unity. And in the 9 lines that make the volleyball, I want 9 I statements. I care. I hustle. I pass. I dig. I cry. I show up. I cheer. She wanted her individual functions on that team. Because without her individual contribution, you don't have a team. There is no I in team, but there is in unity. So Paul says, as a member of the body, I've got to accept my responsibility. And so whatever your job is, however important you think it is or however unimportant you think it is, whether you're a hand or a foot or an eye, Paul says you've got a job to do, accept your responsibility. Second ridiculous situation that can't happen in a body. Verse 17, if the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole body were hearing, where would be the smelling? But now God has set the members, each one of them in the body, just as he pleased. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? Paul says the second thing that can't happen in a body is the whole thing can't look alike. If you just had an eye, it wouldn't be a body, it'd be a monster. If you just had an ear, it wouldn't be a body, it'd be a monster. If you just had a hand, it wouldn't be a body, it'd be a mutant. And Paul says you can't all be the same. In fact, the eclectic nature of the church makes us very, very unique. If we're all of the same socioeconomic background, we're all the same color, we're all the same age, we're all the same likes, we're all the same dislikes, we're not a church, we're a social club. You look at the health of a congregation, you see their diversity, and you'll see the health. And Paul says, God arranged all these different things because that's what makes us function as a body. So there's some things I can't be, some things you can't be. And we can't all be just alike. One of the biggest mistakes we make is we compare ourselves to other people. Either we compare ourselves to other people and feel better about ourselves because we found somebody we can diss on, or we feel bad about ourselves because, well, I compare my insides to your outsides. And if I compare my insides to your outsides, I always lose because I know me very intimately and I only know you superficially. And when we do that, we cheat ourselves. And Paul says, quit worrying about what you're not and celebrate what you are, because you quit trying to be like everybody. I can't minister like Jerry does. Jerry can't minister like I do. I can't do the things you can do. You can't do the things I can do. I run a little ropes course for Wellstone Behavioral. And one of the things we tell folks is be your best. You're not here to be the best. You're just here to be your best. And your 100%, my 100% might be different given the context. When Jackie and I moved to Huntsville, I was 22. She was 19. We moved from Salem, Arkansas to this, what we would consider a metropolitan city. Huntsville's big to us, probably not big to you guys living, you know, in the shadow of Nashville. But so we're there at this large congregation, and we're basically kids. Tim Orbison, who worked with me there for years, said when Lonnie and Jackie moved to Huntsville, the ink wasn't dry on their marriage certificate. So we moved to Huntsville with this young couple. One day after church, Mary Chun said, "You're going to go to my house today for dinner." Here's the cultural difference. I thought, well, that's going to be a long day because we ate dinner after dark where I grew up. She meant lunch. She said dinner. So we're going to go to Europe. And so her husband was the executive vice president for Chrysler. So we drive across town, go into this nice neighborhood, this huge house. Walk in this big, huge house. As we're walking through the house, she says, "We're going to have dinner in the formal dining room." I'd never been in a formal dining room. I didn't know what a formal dining room was. At the Jones house, we had one room where we ate, and that was where the table was. If you didn't eat at the table, you ate on a TV tray so you could watch a black and white TV and check out the wrestling, all right? That's how I grew up. We walk into this room, and there's this huge oak table, this opulent china cabinet, and on the table, there's everything. There's fat forks and skinny forks and long spoons and short spoons and tablespoons and teaspoons and butter knives and serrated knives and sharp knives and cups and glasses and saucers. And I thought, are we going to eat? Are we going to fight? There's enough equipment on this table I could take over a small third world country. And I'm looking at this stuff, and Jackie leans into me and says, "You will not embarrass me." I leaned back over. Said, "Well, what am I supposed to do?" She said, "You eat what Miss Chun eats with what Miss Chun eats it with." I said, "What if I don't like it?" She says, "Rule number one, you will not embarrass me." So I sit down at the table like a good boy, and it's not rocket surgery, okay? I mean, you're just sitting there, and you start from the outside, and you move to the inside. And that's it. Why in the world are there all that stuff on a table? You ever tried to eat soup with a fork? You ever tried to eat a good steak with a spoon? They told a story, supposed to be a true story, this old guy in Arkansas. And they said, "Why do you eat honey and peas?" He said, "Doesn't taste very good, but it holds them on my knife." Well, there's a fundamental misunderstanding about the whole, you'll get that tomorrow, sweetheart. Okay, honey's sticky. Anyway, so there's stuff you have and that has a purpose. Listen to this. And God has set the members, each one of them, as it pleased Him. Quit second guessing your spot on the table and just do your job. Quit worrying about, am I a fork or a knife or a spoon or a sharp knife or a dull knife or a butter knife, and just do the job you've been given to do. Because that which you're naturally good at and that which you're naturally comfortable at is probably your job. And that's it. One of my hobbies is rock climbing. And I use climbing and rappelling to do adventure-based therapy. Used to do some guided climbing, goof around with a ropes course now, and do some things like that. You can have a monster climbing wall right here. I'm telling you right now. put a couple of steel cables around that big H-beam, anchor it off, and we could have some fun. And anyway, so I built this indoor climbing wall for the city of Huntsville. And we were doing youth and recreation services. I was donating time to this thing in an after-school program. And the kids would come from middle schools, and we would teach them to climb. You use the same problem-solving skills in your brain to figure out a climbing route as you do to do math. And so some really interesting stuff. We talk about choices. We talk about anchors. Some really neat stuff. In one of my classes, they came from the Academy of Science and Foreign Languages, and we did a series called Science and PE. And so we did the climbing and talked about the friction and the physics and all kind of stuff. And one of the things that we teach in the class is we teach the students to belay. Now, belaying is a sailing term. It means to hold a rope steady. If we were going to do what we do in the class, it's called top roping. And so if I were to throw a rope over one of those black bars that holds your basketball goal up, and tie one into Jerry. As Jerry climbed up, I would pull the slack in through a friction device on my harness. And so as he goes higher, his rope gets shorter. And if he falls, he just hangs in place. It's a non-dynamic fall. So you're not loading the rope. You're not stressing anything. There's no shock forces. It's called top roping. All amateur rock climbers do top roping. And so we would teach the kids to top rope. And then we make them belay each other. And then on the fourth class, we make them belay one of their parents. Really cool experience to watch a seventh grader be in charge of his dad's safety. You know, the dad gets back on the ground. He says, "Hey, your dad was climbing. You were screaming your head off. What was going on?" "Well, there was a foothold there, and he wouldn't listen to me, and I was scared." Welcome to parenthood. You were in charge of your dad's safety for about a minute and a half, and you lost your mind. He's felt that way about you since you took your first breath. So if he gets a little psychotic when you play t-ball or try to learn to drive, calm down. You've experienced parenthood. Well, in this particular version of our class from the Academy of Science and Foreign Languages, there's a little boy in the class named Chris. And Chris was missing from his elbow down. And we would change the rock patterns so that he could do some one-handed climbing. And he was a real go-getter and was not, you know, not letting anything that was limiting him. And so we've got belay class going on. I've got ropes hanging everywhere. I've got kids hanging everywhere. I've got kids raising a bucket of water off the ground and lowering it so they do it smoothly without dumping any water. And I'm a little distracted. And there's this tug on my harness. "Mr. Lonnie, Mr. Lonnie, Mr. Lonnie, I need to learn to belay." I look over my head, over my shoulders, Chris. And I said, "Well, Chris, you know, typically people use two hands to belay." And Chris said, "Well, typically I just have one." A little African-American kid looked me dead in the eye and said, "Don't tell me what people with two hands can do. Tell me what I can do with the one hand I've got." And outside of this book, maybe one of the two most significant things ever said to me in my life. Don't tell me what people with two hands can do. Tell me what I can do with the one hand I've got. Quit worrying about what you're not, young people, and celebrate who you are. Quit worrying about that you may or may not have academic intelligence. By the way, emotional intelligence is more important than academic intelligence. People with 160 IQ typically work for people with 100 IQ. Don't worry about the ACT test. It doesn't mean you're a success or a failure. It talks about some predictability about college. It doesn't talk about success in life, trust me, okay? So when you start looking at your life instead of saying, "Well, I'm not like him or I'm not like her, I'm not like it." No. God set you on the table as it pleased him. And you may not be a fork, you may not be a spoon, you may not be a saucer, but you are something and you have a function. And quit worrying about what you're not and celebrate and expand what God has created you to be. Everything I have in my life, Jerry has pointed out that I'm not tall. Everything I have in my life is built to my size. I don't call that weird, I call it customized. My bow is 26 inches from axle to axle. In a hand of anybody else, it looked like a toy. I hunt with a guy in Kentucky. He calls it the Ken and Barbie bow. He said, "Let me see that Ken and Barbie bow." Well, it's built for my draw length, not yours. My harness is customized for what I use when I'm climbing. My rifle stock is customized for my short arms and my stocky little body. Everything I have is customized, and I don't say, "Look at that, it's weird." It's designed specifically for a purpose because I'm the one who uses it. And God said, I've designed you specifically for a purpose because I'm the one who uses it. And quit worrying about what you're not and start celebrating what you are. What can I do with the one hand I've got? So you accept your responsibility, you accept your limitations, and then the last thing that he's going to say here, verse 20, but now indeed there are many members, yet one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I don't have any need for you. Or again, the head to the feet, I don't have any need of you. Much rather, those members of the body which we seem to be weaker are necessary. And those members of the body that we think are less honorable, we bestow greater honor on our unpresentable parts. They have greater modesty. But our presentable parts have no need, but God composed the body, having given greater honor to the part which lacks it, that there should be no schism, division in the body, but that the members should have the same care one for another. And if one member suffers, they all suffer with it. And if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Paul says, look, you can't have a body part that says, I don't like my job, I quit. You can't have a body that's made up of the same part. And you can't have a body member look at another body member and say, hey, you know what? We really don't need you. The eye can't say to the hand, I have no need of you. We accept our responsibility. We accept our limitations. And we accept one another. We have to quit making this first tier, second tier, and third tier acceptability in the church. There's no such thing as a second class Christian. God doesn't have any stepchildren. God doesn't have any grandchildren. We're all children. And we've got to learn to accept one another. It's interesting that when he talks about that the members of the body have the same care one for another. If one body member suffers, we suffer with it. If one body member is honored, we rejoice with it. He really describes what Mark Sanborn talks about in his corporate team building stuff, that if you belong to a larger group of folks, you should receive from that group of folks attention, belonging, and support. If you read the Philip Jenkins book, The Lunch Ladies, that's what it is. It's attention, belonging, and support on steroids. If you want to measure the health of this congregation, some Sunday morning the elders stand up and say, hey, church, get out a visitor's card, write down these three words, attention, belonging, and support. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst, 10 being the best, how much attention do you get from this church? How much belonging do you feel from this church? How much support do you get from this church? You collect your cards, add your numbers, give yourselves a grade, and you'll find out how healthy your church is. Now, to be fair, 2 weeks later you come back, elder gets up and says, hey, church, get out a card. Write down these three words, attention, belonging, and support. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst, 10 being the best, how much attention did you give anybody this week? How much belonging did you show someone this week? How much support did you give this week? And you'll find out that folks who don't think they get it usually don't give it. You'll find out that folks who feel like they're on the fringes are on the fringes for a reason. And sometimes that requires us to confront a little dissonance in our lives, and that we have to decide that we're going to be contributors. We're going to have to ourselves give attention, belonging, and support to receive attention, belonging, and support, because it is reciprocal. And what Paul basically says is you've got to change the way you see yourselves. That I don't get to evaluate you on anything other than you're a member of the body. So, verse 18, but now God has set them, I'm sorry, all the way down to verse 26. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now you are the body of Christ, but members individually. That's the closest he's going to get to using the phrase corporate individuality. You're the body of Christ, but you're an individual member. And my status as an individual member affects the way I see you. And I don't get to see you on a horizontal scale. I don't get to look at you about your age, your race, your political background, your sports liking, what school you go to, what job. I get to look at you and say, body of Christ. And if you're a body member and I'm a body member, we have a relationship, and that relationship is through Christ. Jackie was 18 when I married her. I was probably 21. And so when I came home from Arkansas with this beautiful girl, my parents essentially adopted an extra teenager. They had two boys, me and my brother, and then so Jackie. So Jackie shows up at Thanksgiving and Christmas and spring break and family vacations, and she just kind of was raised along with us in our latter part of growing up. My brother's 19 months older than me, didn't get married till he was 39. So I'm already living in Huntsville. Mom and dad live in Oxford. My brother, late in life, starts showing up with this girl named Missy. We didn't hang out. We didn't, you know, I mean, we were all hip deep in life. And so my brother brings this stranger into our lives. And Missy's a neat lady, but she didn't grow up in Velvet Ridge, Arkansas. Her grandfather didn't own a farm. She didn't pick strawberries as a little girl, didn't know how to plow behind a mule. Her idea of roughing it is a Holiday Inn without a pool. And so she's kind of prissy. Let me just, I'll just throw that out there, all right? When they got married, I got invited to the wedding because I'm the brother of the groom. We stand up on this big stage at the University Church in Montgomery, had these big air vents on their stage. I'm standing there. I'm the little brother. I'm bored at weddings. I've been married a long time. They don't hold that much charm for me anymore. Guy says, are there rings present? I thought, you know, if I drop a penny down this air vent, it'll make everybody really shocked. So I did. Missy did not think that was funny. Let me just say that on record right now. That was not a hilarious moment for her. Well, we got past that. They still got married. They end up having children. Well, now the people around them that are having children are naming their children like antique furniture, like Armoire Chippendale and those really weird names. So as a good uncle, I thought, you know what? I could make a contribution to this name thing. I said, if you have a little girl, her first name should be Enya. Her middle name should be Anna. You could call her Enya Anna Jones. I thought that was money. If I thought I'd name my own daughter that. But Missy didn't like that either. She, that was one of those, no, not funny. I'm having some fun at Missy's expense. She's a charming, gracious lady. We go to her house. We are hosted like we are royalty. She doted on Lonnie Beth when she was little. Tried to girdle her up a little bit. Always buying earbobs and sparkly things at birthdays and Christmases. She treats my parents like they're her own parents. Just no issues at all with loving Missy and knowing that Missy loves us. But let me go on record that my personal opinion of Missy is superfluous. She married my brother. And because she is connected to my brother, she is connected to me. And that ends the debate. It has nothing to do with my personal taste. Now, I'm fortunate and I'm lucky that personally we get along. We get each other's humor. We have a lot of positive, but it doesn't matter. She's married to my brother. And because she's married to my brother, she has access to everything I have if she needs it. It'll happen. This phone wiggles in my pocket and says, hey, Lonnie, this is Missy. I need you. I'll make apologies and I'm out the door. And I don't want to sound like that guy, but I'd die for her or kill for her without hesitation. Because my connection to her goes beyond personal. She's connected to my brother. And if you understand, my connection to my brother, you can start to fathom my connection with Missy. But simply because she's connected to Gerald, she's connected to me. You're connected to Christ. You're connected to me. You're connected to Christ. You're connected to me. You're connected to Christ. You're connected. I'm connected to Christ. I'm connected to you. And that's all that matters. That's all that should matter. You are the body of Christ and members individually. And if we ever get that into our minds that our connection here has nothing to do with anything else but Christ, we'd start treating each other differently. We'd start functioning differently. We'd start caring differently. Our churches would actually look like bodies and not groups. Our churches would function like organisms and not just organizations. Now, what he's going to do is he wraps up this discussion as he's going to go through a series of rhetorical questions. Everybody can't be an apostle. Everybody can't be a prophet. Everybody can't be a pastor. Everybody can't be a teacher. Everybody can't be an interpreter. He's going to talk about all these things that everybody can't do. And then he's going to say, but let me show you the most excellent way. And there's no chapter division in the original Greek. I don't know what your job is. I don't know what your miracles are. I don't know what you can do. But let me tell you what everybody can do. Chapter 13 says love. And it really doesn't matter what your talent is. If you do that talent and it's not because of love, then the talent is irrelevant. And so without being able to sit here and say, this is your spiritual job and this is your place on the table and this is your limitation and this is your responsibility, Paul finishes the discussion with the discussion of 1 Corinthians chapter 13 that says, your job is to love. And when you have love, you have perfection. When you have love, you have unity. When you have love, you have maturity. By this shall all men know you're my disciples if you have love one for another. And that's it. That's the message of your relationship with the body, is that you love each other. And however love manifests itself in actions or simply in attitude, it's got to be done. And if we don't love each other, Jesus says you really don't love God. And if you do love God, you'll love each other. I was at a little church in Burney, Missouri. Stan Dowk preaches over there. Stayed over for a Sunday night service. Sunday night, sitting in the back, I was through preaching, and they began to pass out the collection plate. I thought, two collections on a Sunday? Wow. But they weren't putting stuff in. They were taking stuff out. I can't wait for my turn. But when it came by me, I noticed it was little slips of paper. And every Sunday night, they take their church directory, and they've converted it into little slips of paper. And as it comes down the aisle, you pull a name out of it. And that week, that's the person you pray for. That week, that's the person you call. That week, that's the person you say, hey, let's go meet and have an ice cream. That's the person you say, hey, you want to have dinner after church on Wednesday? You want to come to my house for a hamburger? And a little girl in the seventh grade might call a lady who's 70. And a married couple who've been married 55 years might take a high school couple out that's just dating for coffee. And they mix their congregation up because they want it to look like a body, not like a group of people. Attention, belonging, and support. So, what's your relationship with this body? Two really important questions. Question number one, are you a member of this body? Now, just showing up doesn't make you a member. If you have not been baptized in the name of Jesus for remission of your sins, then you're still a guest and a visitor. We love you. We're glad you're here, but you're not a member of the body. Because the only way to be a member of the body is to be baptized by the same Spirit into one body. It works for Jews, it works for Greeks, it works for slave, it works for free, it works for me, it works for you. And if you're not a member of the body, we want you to be, not just because we want you to be part of the body, but you still have a sin problem that's unaddressed. And you can't address the sin problem without baptism. Question number two, are you a member of the body? And if you are a member of the body, do you have that mindset of corporate individuality? Have you connected to these people? Have you accepted your responsibility? Have you accepted your limitations and you're accepting one another? And if you're not, the church can't reach its potential because you're not doing what you're supposed to do, and you should probably address that. Any of those concerns, church membership or church faithfulness, you can address that. Privately, you talk to anybody after these services are dismissed, say, hey, I need to study, hey, I need to pray, I need to be baptized. We'll take care of it, but we also offer a public way to take care of that. We sing a song, we typically call it a song of encouragement or a song of invitation. When we sing, Jerry will be down here or maybe some of your elders to receive anyone. And if you have a prayer request, need to study, want to be baptized, or want to just simply make a commitment that says, I'm ready to invest into this body, then you have that opportunity this morning. While we stand, while we sing.